once more into the breach, dear friends. I'll fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is currently off in Colorado being cool. He's always a lot more cool than I am, so that's pretty standard. And telephone number in here, presuming that today is Saturday, August 4th, where you are, is 254-773-1400. We were talking about what happened a century ago, and I think it's important to recognize that. I think it's very important. There's a book called Generations, The History of America's Future, 1584 to 2069, by Strauss and Howe. And I'll say that again, because I think it's a very, very important book. I think it's worth reading. I think it's an easy read, relatively speaking, compared with most books about economics. Again, it's Generations, The History of America's Future, 1584 to 2069, by Strauss and Howe. And it was written, it's still in print, but it is not a very popular book right now. It's not a big seller. It was written back in the 1970s, I think, actually published in the 80s or 90s. But it has now been in print for over 20 years. And if you read the book, you will find it to be amazingly accurate in forecasting what's going on in the United States today and in the markets today. The premise in the book is that there are only four generations and they just repeat themselves through history. They even have an appendix where they go back into the Old Testament and show that same four-generational cycle repeating over and over again. And there, it's hard to define where you want to start the generational cycle because there are four and they just circle around again and again. But for the sake of my experiences, what I say is first there is a heroic generation that rescues us from a depression, a severe economic or what's called a socioeconomic event that's very unpleasant. They're called the Greatest Generation. They fought World War II and they drug us bodily, if necessary, out of the depression of the 1930s. Depressions tend to lead to wars, major wars. And this heroic generation arises every time we have one, making great sacrifice and pulls us out of there. And that particular generation tends to go on and on and on and on and on. Ronald Reagan was part of that generation. And a whole series of people were part of that generation. We get presidents from that generation. The generation that follows them is called the compliant generation. And the compliant generation is certainly different. They are not heroic. They simply follow the rules. And why do they follow the rules? Because they personally experienced this horrific thing, like in our recent history. They experienced the Depression and World War II. And they saw the heroic generation drag us out and take charge. And the heroic generation then tells them what to do, and they do it. I mean, to give you an example, Eisenhower was part of the heroic generation. And in my case, as a boomer, the people who taught me in school were generally too young to have fought in World War II. And they are part of the compliant generation, and they insisted on following the rules. And following the rules is the nature of that generation. That generation is willing to make lots of compromises, sometimes called the compromise generation. If you go back into the 19th century, before the Civil War, there's a whole series of laws that were passed called the Missouri Compromise and a whole series of other compromises that, according to Strauss and Howe in their book Generations, it's the same generation just doing it earlier in time. Then following the compliant compromise generation, you get the boomers. Now, the boomers didn't experience the Depression and they didn't experience World War II. However, the people that raised them did, and so they fear poverty and they fear domination by a foreign power, and so they tend to be very much spend their lives in pursuit of financial security. They tend to have nice houses. They tend to create an economic boom in the country when they come along. They look back in time and they look back to their childhood and they see the way they thought things were at the time with there had been a crisis and we'd come out on top and everything was wonderful. And they tend to be more and more radicalized as time goes on. Politically, they tend to be very, very, a very polarized generation. And as long as they're in charge, society tends to be very, very, very polarized. Some of them think that the solution to the problem that they encountered when they were children is, in our society today, is more governmental controls, because that's part of what brought us out of the Depression. They tend to be on the left, and the ones on the right tend to be the ones who say that more self-determinism, more opportunity for entrepreneurs, and more differential between the wealthy and the poor is a good thing, and those things are what make America great or make any country great and go forward. The interesting thing is, Ben, you find this roughly every 100 years, you find exactly the same pattern that shows up again and again and again, which, of course, explains why in 1873 we had a market crash. It's called the Panic of 1873. You come forward to 1973, you had a 50% drop in the market. We had a market panic in the United States in 1898 and in 1998. Beginning in the year 2000 and in the year 1900, we had a major bear market. So we're running roughly 100 years apart in some very interesting cycles. Now, the cycles aren't perfect because we're currently not in World War or coming out of World War I. We're not having World War I at the present. The war that we fight that seems to be futile and never-ending, that kind of turns everybody off, is the war we're having in Southwest Asia, which has a lot of parallels with World War I. It's a war that nobody wanted to get into, and certainly nobody wanted to be in for a really long period of time, but we're in it, and it's there, and it's kind of a low-key struggle between Russia and NATO, and it is probably going to wind up with an indeterminate end. There'll be truces, just like there is in Iraq right now. We'll pull away from it, and it will erupt back into another war in the future. This is the way, again, history flows. It looks like the Middle East is the equivalent of the demarcation line between German control and French control in Europe was 100 years ago. And we'll probably see another war there down the road, and it'll be one that'll finally settle things. That's just the way history works. Now, so let's go forward with the generations. The next generation, after the boomers, we refer to it as the X generation. In the previous century, was the flappers, the flapper generation of the Roaring Twenties. We're about to enter into the Roaring Twenties again. In other words, if you follow this premise, and I'm not the only one, and Strauss and Howe are certainly not the only one who've seen this echoing through history. Mark Twain said it very well when he said, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes." Probably the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, George Santayana, said, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it." And he was referring to the fact that those who do not study history, who do not remember what happened 100 years ago or what happened 50 years ago, are very, very liable to make the same mistakes that people made 50 or 100 years ago in mass and create the same problem. Very few people who are in the market today, who are active and doing a lot of trading, mostly that's younger people, younger than me, which isn't saying much, I'm 68, are generally unaware of what went on in the 1990s. Those old folks talk about the 1990s, and we talk about the tech boom of the 1990s, the dot-com boom of the 1990s. And frankly, when I talk about that to our younger clients, or when I talk about that to people in their 30s, or even their 40s, they're pretty much clueless as to what went on during that period. And certainly if I talk about what happened in the 1970s, that's ancient history, and it doesn't really register with them. It's not taught in the schools. You can get a doctor in finance and never take a course in history. And as a result, we are very liable to repeat the same mistakes in mass that people did in the past. And each generation then is raised by people who influence our worldview. And this cycle kind of runs through the four generations. And again, they're the heroic generation, the compromise or compliant generation. You have the boomers. You have the Xers. And by the way, now we have the millennials. The millennials are the heroic generation again. And my anecdotal survey of the millennials says that they are interested in focusing on public service and making the world a better place, which is incidentally exactly what drove the train of the heroic generation that rescued us from the Depression and World War II. So we go through, if we make the presumption that we go through the cycle, we should be able to look back about 100 years and see strong parallels with what's going on today, if in fact this hypothesis of a four-generational cycle that lasts about 23 to 25 years per generation is accurate and valid. And this is what I find to be ironic. Apple crossed $1 trillion, becoming the largest capitalized, as far as capital is concerned and value on the market is concerned, becoming the largest company in the history of the U.S. stock market. And the largest company on the New York stock market. Well, guess what? About 100 years ago, there was a company that did very much the same thing. And it was so famous and so powerful that as the New York Stock Exchange was forming, they gave it a single letter, T. And it's AT&T. And AT&T had developed, actually Alexander Graham Bell had developed, a new form of communication that was changing everything. And it was the telephone and the telephone system, which included wire transfers of funds. It included the news wires, as they were called, that the teletype, which I remember when the teletype was how we got news in a radio station. And in the background, you could hear the click, 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 all the going all the time, because that was because it was a teletype going back there. That was something that was invented as part of the communication revolution that was created by Alexander Graham Bell. And it was all dominated by one company called American Telephone and Telegraph. The previous century, there was another revolution in communications. It was called the telegraph. In the 20th century, we had a revolution called the telephone. And in the 21st century, we have the smartphone, which is occasionally used as a telephone, but mostly is something completely different. Steve Jobs and Alexander Graham Bell fill very much the same slot. T and AAPL are very much the same thing happening 100 years later. And it changes the way we communicate. It changes the speed at which things happen. It destabilizes society. There's a lot of things happen when there's a change of technology. For example, World War I was largely because the diplomats still depended upon ambassadors who had to travel by ship and train to get to a location with letters in their pouches and written instructions, and they would have to go back to their capitals to get written instructions, and then they would go back from there. They would go to wherever they were stationed and negotiate with the country, and that's how things were worked out. Physically, people traveled back and forth in order to communicate. However, in the early 20th century, the telephone, the telegraph, and the teletype were coming into strength, and the military were the first to use them. So armies could be moved at the speed of wire telephone communications, while diplomats were still using longhand and trains and ships to move their communications around. Armies were moving faster than diplomatic communications. The end result, we had a war that nobody really intended to happen. Could that happen again? Is it likely to be happening right now? Absolutely. Things happen that governments can't control and diplomats are not ready for on a very regular basis because of, right now, for example, tweets. The Twitter revolution is certainly changing the way that groups form and how they do. And at the same time, we're getting a lot of false information spread through the new, very low-cost or non-cost media. And as the false information is spread, inevitably it causes people to radicalize, because people tend to see what they want to see, and it's not going through a filter. That's not going through the filter of an editor. So when we see Apple, a communications company, which is incidentally also a manufacturing company, it's one of the largest manufacturing companies in the United States. They make iPhones. They make computers. So it's a combination of several things. You see Apple rising to the top just as AT&T or T rose to the top in the late 19-teens and into the 1920s. It was the dominant stock in the market. It was a high-tech stock. Well, what's the equivalent of a Ford or General Motors? And the answer is probably Tesla. Now, Tesla may not wind up on top of the game because General Motors was actually formed from a bunch of companies that were trying to do the same thing. But we're having an automobile revolution, a transportation revolution that's going on right now. And it's a combination of the electric vehicle and the self-driving vehicle, which is going to revolutionize transportation very much the way the internal combustion engine revolutionized transportation in the 20th century. Once again, it tends to destabilize things. It causes tremendous shifts in the job market. It causes a lot of things to change, and it's probably not a bad idea to be aware of that and to think about that as far as long-term planning is concerned. But it's also really, really simply good to be aware of it, to be aware that things are not going to stay the same. Things are going to change. They've always changed, and if you question, if you think all things are the way they always have been and they probably should be, I just recommend you drive over to Holland and you take a look at that town that once was full of prosperity, or drive over to Taylor and drive around the town, drive around the residential streets, look at what used to be the public school system there where the police department is now, and look at the extravagance that was put into the buildings there and the fact that those towns are now very much in ruins. And you got the question, which I raised years ago, is why were they very prosperous then and in ruins now? And the answer is because transportation changed. Transportation changed a lot. In the beginning of the 20th century, there were towns that were half a day's transport from farms because agriculture was a really big deal. And agriculture is where most people worked. And when people wanted to do business, they didn't want to go more than half a day, so somewhat less than half a day travel, using a wagon driven, pulled by horses. And so one day travel from town to town worked out pretty well, with half a day being you could go in and come back out on the same day, if you were a farmer. Then if you look at the little agricultural towns spread through East Texas, most of which have largely dried up, but they're still there, you see that if you go back and calculate how far a wagon on a reasonably well-maintained dirt road could travel, pulled by a horse in a day or half a day, and you see that about every one day's journey, you have a little town with the farms were at the time concentrated closer to those towns, the towns where they could do business. And then, of course, those towns tended to be on railroad tracks. And if they weren't on railroad tracks, they tended to dry up, just as Salado did. Then, with the advent of the truck and the tractor, all that changed. Now, the farmer could go a lot further. Manufacturing became a bigger deal in the United States. Agriculture became far more productive, which I think the productivity surge of the 1920s is what caused tremendous numbers of people to be put out of work while the economy was still going like gangbusters in the 1920s. There was a huge unemployment appeared in the agricultural sector. The prices of food dropped to the point where farms had a lot of trouble staying in business. People who came back after World War I and took out mortgages to buy farms, suddenly found themselves unable to pay their mortgages. And this piled on and piled on, even as the economy kept going strong based on the new manufacturing basis that it was in, until it crashed in 1929. And it tends to all crash at once rather violently, and it tends to be a shock and an unexpected event, even though it happens about once a century. The crash before the 1929 crash was admittedly not exactly 100 years, and there's some very good reasons for that. It was in 1837, but it still happened. And again, it was for the same reasons exactly, and I won't go into that. I could bore you to tears with this. But we're having the change happen again. And as we go into the 2020s, again, if we follow history, and it's amazingly consistent, right around 2020, it's a zero year. we should have a recession. It should have a relatively large impact on our psychology, but it should be what's called a cyclical recession, which means we go into it and we come back out of it within 18 months. Then we should go into the 1920s or the 2020s in this case, going like gangbusters, and that's when great strides will be made. This will make tremendous rises in productivity, great shifts in where people are employed in the nation, great advances in education and technology, and great prosperity is probably going to ensue in the 2020s, just like it did in the 1920s, and everything is lining up to do that. The robotic revolution should hit its stride sometime in the 2020s, and there will be a lot of the repetitious, back-breaking, mind-numbing work that people do today the jobs will disappear because there will be robots doing them more efficiently and more effectively than humans can do. And it's all, in the end, that's a good thing. Khan was saying a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about this is really scary when you look at the fact that somewhere between 30 and 60% of the jobs in the United States, depending on which site I use and whose study I use, are jobs that probably will be replaced by robos. And, you know, it's no different than we saw in the 1920s when crops were planted and harvested by hand. The cultivation was done behind a mule. And it took a lot of people to do agricultural work. And today it takes very few people. We have less than 2% of the number of people today working in agricultural production than we had at the beginning of the 20th century. But we have also record low unemployment because other jobs were created at a faster rate than those jobs disappeared. The difficulty is, of course, when you have people who are trained to do one kind of work and who are very proficient at doing a kind of work, and then that job disappears and they're older, it's rough. It's really, really rough for them to become employed with the new kind of work. In the 20th century, the issue was trying to get people from agriculture into industrial work. They're completely different kinds of work. One involved working with animals a lot, and a lot of working with the dirt and working outside. The other one involved repetitious mechanical movements in factories. And the difference between the two were like night and day. And it also forced people to move from where they had been before, places like Holland, where agricultural work was available, to places like Detroit, where operating assembly lines was available. And if you're broke and you just lost your job, moving out of your community where your family is a really, really hard thing to do. It generally takes a crisis of some kind to make that happen. Unfortunately, that's just the reality of the way it works, and that's the way it happens every century. This great displacement of people with a change in technology is how we got the West settled. We look back in the mid-1800s and we say why. We just acknowledge the fact that this is the great pouring out of pioneers moving into the Western United States and building farms and pouring into California in the mid-1800s. Why were they doing that? Well, because there had been a technological revolution on the East Coast where they had worked before. The steam engine had become dominant, and a lot of the jobs that were dependent upon waterfalls previously, if you didn't have a waterfall and you didn't have a wheel to turn something to make a factory work, then you didn't have a factory. But as soon as the steam engine became widely available and the telegraph became widely available, it changed the location of production. At the same time, the first mechanical devices for making agriculture more efficient, the McCormick Reaper, for example, came into existence, and it came into existence in the crisis of 1837, but it really hit its stride following the war between the states. And as a result, you had a tremendous number of people who didn't have work. And the government stepped in and said, passed the Homestead Act and said, we will give you free land if you go west, stake it out, claim it, and farm it. The only thing that was missing is how do they get the produce that they farm to market? And the answer was the railroad. And it was a wonderful combination between corporate profit and the government's desire to not have mobs of millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people out of work wandering around the country, creating a lot of unhappiness. And so the railroads were given huge tracts of land on either side, the Union Pacific and later the Southern Pacific and the Northern Pacific, to build railroad lines to the West Coast. They were in. They were rewarded for that by the government, not only with giving them the right-of-ways, which are still in use, but also by giving them large tracts of land on either side of the railroad, which they literally gave away to potential farmers. And later, the government got involved and with the Homestead Act to give the rest of the land away. Why did they do that? Well, because they had a lot of people out of work, because of a change in technology, the advent of the steam engine and the telegraph particularly. And then they also had a need to produce more food and to produce more prosperity in the country. And so you had this tremendous surge in railroads, which incidentally created a huge bubble in a crash in the market when they were over-invested. That was the crash of 1873. And in many ways, the railroad crash and the dot-com crash were similar events, but there were actually several railroad-related crashes where people overinvest in railroads, and they didn't make the profits they expected to make, and it collapsed and took the market down. But there's this repeating pattern of real estate causing the crashes as well. So what we have is this pattern repeating itself today. We have this pattern of, with a great change in technology, there will be a lot of jobs lost, and it will generally require the government to step in. What happened in the 20th century? Well, you had this tremendous mass of people who previously had worked in agriculture and who were very proficient with animals and harnesses and plows and with picking cotton and chopping cotton and doing all the things that had to be done by hand. They were out of work. There was no central program to train them. The government stepped in and put a bandage on it with the first, with the Works Progress Administration. And when that was ruled unconstitutional, by the way, liberals were elected to do this. The Republicans had dominated until the crash, and then the Democratic liberals took over. And the Democratic liberals, specifically Franklin Delano Roosevelt, gives credit for this, but Congress was the one who passed the laws. First set up the Works Progress Administration to hire all these people out of work. And then they set up the Civilian Conservation Corps when the Supreme Court, which was ultra-conservative at the time because a lot of there was a series in the teens, just like there is now, of conservative presidents who appointed a lot of conservative judges to the Supreme Court. But the Depression persisted. We kind of almost got out of it, and then we fell back into it when there was an attempt to take the government's controls off of the economy. A lot of people don't know. 1929, obviously, things started downhill in a hurry. 1934, we pretty much hit the bottom. But they don't realize that in 1937, we pretty much crawled out of it, only to fall back in 38. Why? Because the government pulled a lot of its benefit programs. The benefits to farmers, one of which was activated by President Trump to give $12 billion to soybean farmers because of the tariff wars, were enacted during that period of time to allow the president to basically buy up or support the price of crops during this period when the crop prices were collapsing. So how did we finally take all of these agricultural workers and teach them how to operate mechanical things and put them to work? And the answer was World War II. World War II came along. We declared war, instituted the draft, and there were a lot of people out of work who suddenly had a job either in the armed forces or were hired by factories to make defense-related mechanical devices, tanks and ships and airplanes. People who knew nothing about how to set a rivet, how to drill, how to use machine tools, but they were taught because we had a crisis and a necessity to make it happen. So this happened actually a couple of times in the last couple of centuries, once per century. And I frankly don't see any reason why it won't happen this century. In the, I strongly suspect we will have a runaway growth and prosperity in the 2020s following a recession around 2020. And by the way, all the short-term indicators, including Moody's Analytics, which tends to be one of the most accurate forecasters, are predicting a high probability of a recession in 2020. Why? Well, because we're over-surging right now, and which we did, by the way, almost exactly 100 years ago. We produced a big surge effect in the economy. World War I is the proximate cause of that, when we did some things to generate a lot of economic growth in a short period of time. In this particular case, we did it with tax cuts. The tariffs are starting up, which again follows what's happened in the last two centuries. But then as we came out of that, we encounter a recession, and then we encounter a tremendous technological innovation. And by the way, the technological innovation is largely spurred on by the recession. When companies have more cash than they know what to do with, they don't do a lot of innovating. When they find themselves squeezed suddenly, they will tend to get out there and find some way to do things more effectively and more efficiently. And that's, the robotics are not to the point where they're particularly effective at this point. We're getting there. And the Tesla is kind of the lead in that. But we expect to see it happen. And it will turn around. And again, it's not going to happen next year. And it probably won't happen in the next 3 to 5 years. But sometime in the 2020s, I think you can expect to see a tremendous displacement of jobs, of society in general. In which case, it's probably, if you're looking for work during that period, it's probably a good idea to be flexible, to understand that a lot of anything that is done today that is repetitious and mindless, where you get so bored when you're doing it, you can hardly stand it, because it's so mechanical, will almost certainly be taken over within the next 10 years or so by some form of robotic activity, because it is robotic activity. And that means the jobs that exist in that area right now won't exist in the future. What will exist in the future? Well, somebody's got to take care of those robots, and somebody has got to provide. It's important to look around and say, what can't be done by robots? And what jobs are going to be created to take care of the robotic issues? And that's, we should be able to look right now at education and see that emerging. By the way, we can. You can. It was a survey that I read this week, I think it was in The Economist, that talked about where it's either Financial Times or The Economist, that talked about where student loans make sense and where they don't make sense, and it is an amazing differential. There's an awful lot of areas in medical science where, in the medical practitioner world, where people are suffering many years down the road with huge amounts of debt, and it cuts deeply into their income, and it's questionable whether it's a good idea to go in there and borrow the money. On the other hand, nurses, computer technicians, accountants, there are certain areas where people are in greater demand, but it costs less. Engineers are included in that, by the way. Where people are in a greater demand, and you can get, and people get through school with a far lower student loan burden when they come out on the other side, and they do far better. And that's if you're looking or to advising or thinking about a college education right now, it's very important that you take a look at those studies and see not who you perceive to be the most wealthy, but who is it that's coming out of school today that does the best. There's a whole series of areas in there that have tremendous potential. And this is, again, follows history. 100 years ago, there was a big education revolution where people needed to get a high school education. previous to that, the ninth grade is where most people graduated. Today, it's more and more important to either have a good technical education with a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, and we just need to recognize that as a reality. By the way, physician's assistants and nurse practitioners are among the most efficient, effective, and better paid people. The net pay in some areas, and by net pay I mean net of student loan cost, for physician's assistants and nurse practitioners is actually in some, if you want to measure it against the cost and against the loan burden that you wind up with, is actually they're actually doing better than a family practice physician. And that's sort of an ironic thing. It's up around $90,000 for those two areas. And that's general pay early in the career, and it seems to be working out very well for them, and whereas it takes much longer to go through school to become a physician. And again, this is an area where computer diagnosis is going to become a bigger and bigger thing, and you're going to have a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant using a computer to diagnose you, and there'll probably be a physician in the background for a long time who looks at it and says, yeah, that's right. And there'll be fewer physicians and more nurse practitioners and physician's assistants doing business, and more nurses. It's one of those great cycles of history that goes on. Well, I've gone on and on and on and on, and this is KTEM. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. And we actually do need to run some commercials so KTEM can, so Town Square Media can pay for the electricity and things like that. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. And I cannot take responsibility for the sounds that come over the air during commercials. Those of you who are listening live on the air, that's just the way it's set up in here. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. We've been talking about history and where we are in history. And I think it's really important to understand. And why do I think it's important to understand? Well, there's a lot more I could talk about, but we're down to about 12 minutes left or 11 minutes left in the second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach today. Oh, well, we do have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, I think you're on the air. Go ahead. Nope, just got a dial tone. So apparently they weren't on the air. Okay, I'm starting to get the hang of the way that the buttons work in here. If, in fact, you were on the air, yep, that's okay. We don't have anybody on the air, and you wanted to call back. I'm pretty much down to where I understand the unmarked faders on this board here and where they are and which ones go where. Okay, once more, we have a caller. And caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello. Yes.
Yes, sir. Are we on the air?
You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Basically, this has been an excellent history lesson, and I'm trying to figure out how I can get a recording of this. Grandson and grandchildren.
We will have it on our website. It's going to take a little while because we have to get it from the station, and then we go through it, and then we put it on our website as a podcast for today. And it is my recommendation to anyone, if you really want to understand this, is there's three books. One of which is a very easy read, one of which is a pretty easy read, and the other one is going to take you to think a lot, but it is readable by anybody with a reasonable education. The first one is the one I mentioned. Generations, The History of America's Future, 1584 to 2069 by Strauss and Howe. It basically predicts where, this is written, actually they did their work on this in the 70s and 80s, and they predict today that we will be a very highly polarized country, highly divided and basically at each other's throats, and we'll have a controversial president at this point. And I think that's, by the way, that's my standard for reading economics books, is they were written at least 20 years ago, and they perfectly predict what's going on today.
Okay.
And the second one is The Great Wave. I think it's Pricing Trends, in, or it's Pricing Revolutions or Pricing Trends in the Flow of History by David Hackett Fisher. He makes a big prediction about the about the 21st century, and he's based on what happened in the 20th century. He predicts, and when he wrote this, there weren't any failed nation states anywhere on the planet. He predicts we will see a chaotic collapse of civilization that works its way in the 21st century from the periphery, what we used to call the third world. We now call developing or emerging, developing, I think, is our emerging economies. And what he's predicting is we will have more severe weather, and it will be more extreme and last longer in the extremes. And partially as a result, you will see nation states around the periphery of civilization start to fail, and that will gradually work its way inward. Now, that's the core, on the other hand, doesn't fail. It actually thrives in this, but around the edges, things are going to fail. And again, when he wrote this, there weren't any failed nation states in the world. And today, there are several dozen countries that don't have a government. Venezuela, by the way, is now considered to be a failed nation state. The government doesn't have any control of what's going on. Sudan, Libya. I mean, you start down the list, and it's a pretty big list of nations where everything has collapsed, and his predictions are amazingly accurate so far. Now, the third one is the hardest one to read. It is the shortest book, but it is the one with the most value. And I mean, when I say most value, it's off the scale. It's called Structure and Change in Economic History by Douglas North, and Douglas is spelled with two S's. It is the core book for which he won the Nobel Prize, and I think it was 1992 or 93. It was 93, I think. He won the Nobel Prize in economics. There's no math in the book. In other words, he's an economist, and he's a co-founder of a school of economics called New Institutional Economics. But he does an amazingly accurate job from a book written in the 1970s, in describing what's going on in the world today with the collapse in community. I mean, Twitter obviously didn't exist in the 1970s. Facebook didn't exist. The internet was unheard of. But what he said was coming was a technological revolution that would collapse the cost of communications. And this is why this thing is so important. He says it's happened in the past. It's happened, this is the third time it's happened since the fall of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was also a collapse in the cost of communication as they built better and better roads. But each time communication costs collapse, the glue that holds society together collapses with it. And he has a very clear statement in there that I love. He said, the stability of any socioeconomic system, and I'm going to translate this into something that's easily understood rather than the words he actually used. The stability of any economic system is directly proportional to the cost of communication. In other words, the more expensive communication is, the more stable a society is. The less expensive it gets, the less stable it gets. And when it drops to zero, and it has effectively dropped to zero with Twitter, then you get great instability in society, and you can't tell what's truth and what's not truth, and this produces a lack of faith in government, which causes societal collapse. But the good news is, and I got to throw this in here, is he said there is something that contributes tremendously to the stability of a socioeconomic system, and it's called property rights.
Oh.
And you happen to be living in the country with the highest property rights in the world, and you happen to be living in the state, presuming you're calling from Texas,
right,
with the highest property rights in the United States. And as a result, the higher the property rights, the higher the property rights accorded its citizens by a society, the more stable that society becomes and the more resilient it becomes. Which is his explanation, and I think it's a very good one, for why
4 minute stations, 4 minutes away.
We went into the 1600s with what we now call Great Britain, United Kingdom, being a little minor third world country on the periphery of Europe. We came out of the collapse of the 1600s, which Gutenberg, by the way, is the one who collapsed communication costs with his movable type printing press. It no longer took a bunch of monks to create written communications. Now they could be mass produced. And after he executed a communication cost collapse, there was a societal collapse across Europe in a war, the 30 Years' War, that wiped out 80% of the population of Europe, and it only ended because they ran out of people capable of fighting. But coming out of that, England was the dominant power in Europe. Why? Well, because the yeomen had property rights. I mean, it really, this is, I'm summarizing a tremendous amount of information here. But we're yeomen, and we have tremendous property rights in the United States. Fee simple ownership, which we take for granted. The government just can't come in and take your property without due process.
Yeah.
And generally, they can't even, it's really hard for them to take it even with due process. The government cannot just come in and arbitrarily take your property. Well, in Mexico, the government can. In China, the government can. In most of Europe, the government can. If the government decides it wants your property, it can take it. But we don't. We have a rule in the United States, and to a lesser extent in Great Britain, that the government doesn't own your property, you do. And they not only can they not take it easily, if they do take it, they have to pay you fair market value for it. And they have to show an overwhelming public need to take it. Anyway, those three books are tremendous. And this will be a podcast on the personalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Generally takes us about 2 weeks to get it on there as a podcast.
I had to chuckle when you were talking about ownership and the government can't take it away from you. Sometimes I think that my retirement is all based on real estate.
Right.
Rentals. And sometimes I wonder if I'm not renting my property from the state of Texas because of the property taxes.
Well, you do have to pay property taxes, but I will tell you this. They're lower in Texas than they are in most other states.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't have an income tax. You don't have a state income tax. So, by the way, that is the property rights are one of the prime reasons, because Texas has higher property rights than any other state, and you notice where businesses are going. Yeah, admittedly, we do not have the lowest income taxes. We don't have the lowest tax rate in the United States.
Oh, I know.
But we do have the highest inflow of businesses coming to Texas and setting up when they leave other states. And a lot of that has to do with the very, very high level of property taxes, not property rights, we accord the citizens of the state of Texas. And there's a very good reason for that. When Texas was formed, is because Americans didn't have particularly good property rights. And in the Depression that began in 1837, a lot of people lost their farms. And that we didn't have a bankruptcy law, and we had debtor prisons, and people would write GTT on the door of their house, which is where we get the term get out of town.
Yeah.
And GTT stood for gone to Texas.
Right. I knew that years ago.
So we're out of time, and this has been the Personal Wealth Coach, and it's about time to break for con. And thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. Another I appreciate camp. It.